Time to take a look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife. Larry Mueller here with a couple of regular guests. One of them, David Drake, Extension Wildlife Specialist and professor in the Department of Wildlife Ecology, Forest and Wildlife Ecology. David, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Larry, it's nice to be with you on this beautiful day.
And it's nice to have Jamie Knack back as well. Jamie's an Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist. Jamie, good to see your smiling face.
Always. I echo David. What a beautiful day.
Both, again, as I mentioned, affiliated in the Division of Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. So we'll take a look at wildlife babies. We'll take a look at spring migration, loons falling out of the air, and other things as well. We'll take your questions, too, so you can join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Well, let's talk about babies. We talk about this every spring, but it's important to remind people what they should do if they find a wildlife baby. How can you tell if a baby is truly orphaned, Jamie?
Yeah, you're right, Larry. We cover this a lot, but the more we can get messaging out to the public, the more we can actually help wildlife and educate people on, you know, when an animal needs our help and when it's just simply doing what that particular species does. And so baby animals or wildlife animals take care of their young much different than we do. It's quite often where the young animal spends most of its time throughout the day without the mother nearby. The mother may be feeding or keeping a distance from the young to avoid attracting predators to an animal like a fawn or a baby bunny that's not capable of fleeing or avoiding that predation. So the biggest key is to know whether it's appropriate to intervene or whether just a step back and observe type situation might be the most practical or most important way to handle that situation. So obviously, if you see an animal that's injured, it appears sick, it's, you know, moving in circles, it has foaming at the mouth, a visible bleeding or injury, those are all times to call a wildlife rehabilitator. And we encourage you to always call first. Try not to just go and pick up baby bunnies because you believe they're abandoned. Call first. Or better yet, go to the Wisconsin DNR's website. There's an educational effort called Keep Wildlife Wild. It's a combination of the Department of Natural Resources, wildlife rehabilitators across the state, and Extension is involved in that. I've had the pleasure of being involved in this effort. And so that website contains a lot of really nice information, some species-specific information on ecology of different animals. There's also a link on how you can find a local wildlife rehabilitator. What many people don't realize is that wildlife rehabilitators are licensed. Wisconsin is pretty proactive in terms of their requirements. They require you to have a mentor, to pass an examination, a checkup of your facilities, and so on. So there's a lot that goes into that licensing. And again, the idea is to call first before you potentially create a situation where you've taken wildlife from a mother. And I'll just add, we just went through this at home. I was able to show my daughters this, but working in the yard, this is the time of year where we're turning mulch or adding mulch to our landscaping. And we noticed an area just next to a small evergreen shrub that had been raked out. And I kind of looked to repair it. And sure enough, I found some rabbit fur and some dry grass and dig a little deeper. And there are some 5 little bunnies with their eyes closed right there. So show the girls quickly, cover it all back up. We actually set a trail camera so we weren't disturbing it regularly, but I could then show them, look, we never see mom there during the day. But when you look at the trail camera, you notice that she comes at dusk and she comes in the morning. Baby rabbits have really large stomachs. They can hold a lot of milk. So mom would come in, we'd see them nursing on her and only for a few minutes and she'd be gone. So what a great experience, for the kids. A couple other of just things to think about right now at this time of the year is if you have a nuisance situation where you want to trap and remove an animal, it's baby animal season. So you may trap that mother, but you may be leaving or orphaning young, whether that be a raccoon or a squirrel. And so you really want to be thoughtful and mindful of that situation too. And also another big one, window wells around the home seem like we have a lot of baby animals or even amphibians that get trapped in them. If you could just place a cover on that window well to prevent these animals from falling in, again, you can do a lot of good. So tips like that, go to that Keeping Wildlife Wild website. It's really a great source of information where you're kind of thinking about what should I do in this situation. And again, call that rehabilitator. Another really big reason to call them again this year is they have additional guidelines related to COVID. So they may be understaffed, have different, points of contact with the public. And they also have some animals that they currently can't take in, like weasels and bobcats. So things like mink and badgers and fishers. The concern is humans taking in these animals for rehabilitation, perhaps transmitting COVID to them and then releasing these animals back into the wild, where we could potentially create a situation where we're putting COVID into the wildlife population. So as of right now, there are some species rehabilitators are not taking in. So call first.
Call first. Good advice there. Lots of good advice. And we may get some more questions as we move along relating to this. Let's turn to birds for a minute. Lots of stuff going on in the bird world. What's going on with the annual migration, David?
Oh, it depends on where you are in the state, obviously. We had down here in the southern part of the state this past weekend, we had weather in the 80 degree range, mid-80s. And that was brought to us by a very strong southerly wind. So those southerly winds brought up a lot of migratory birds with them. And then the winds turned to the north. And so those birds, typically as they're flying north, they're not going to fly into a headwind. So they kind of were stuck here for a couple of days. And turned out to be awesome birding. I was out planting some native plants in my yard a couple of days ago, and I heard a Nashville warbler calling and black and white warbler. I saw a yellow rump warbler. I went birding over by Pheasant Branch Conservancy, which is a natural area not too far from where I live in Middleton, a suburb of Madison. Saw Louisiana water thrush, black pole warblers, heard black throat green warblers. So this is a pretty, if you're into birds, this is the time
good
of the
time.
Year. For because it's the birds are coming back up. You haven't seen these birds for 6-7 months, something like that. It also gives you a good idea, a clue that spring and summer really is coming after a long winter. So it's always kind of a nice recharge for sure.
Christina and Racine emailed some photos of her backyard and the birds in her backyard. She lives in a very urban area, about a half a mile west of Lake Michigan. She's wondering why she's able to attract so many and such a variety of birds. I'm not sure I can identify all of them. Even with all the noise, and I'm assuming she means traffic noise and so forth.
Well, birds are pretty adaptable to begin with. But during the migration, those birds have to go from their southerly wintering grounds to the northern breeding grounds. And there's a lot of inhospitable habitat, if you will, that they have to navigate to get between the winter grounds and the summer breeding grounds. And that includes a lot of cities and urban areas. And, she describes her property that she's not too far from Lake Michigan. And Lake Michigan is a major visual corridor or a visual landmark for birds as they're flying north and south during the migrations, either spring or fall. It is likely that because she's so close to Lake Michigan, she's getting a lot of birds. But I also looked at her pictures, and it looks like she's got a lot of very good habitat. She has a lot of different types of feeders out there, so seed feeders, and it looks like she has some oranges for the Oreos and grosbeaks and things like that. So the more diversity of food you can provide to these animals, especially during migration, they'll migrate at night, and then they'll sit down or land during the day and refuel and rest, and then they'll take off the next night. And so, So it also looked like she has some pretty good habitat. And so you can attract a lot of birds no matter where you are, whether it be the city or the country, based on a diversity of food, a diversity of habitat. And most importantly, if you can provide natural native planting, so the more native vegetation you can put on the ground on your property, the more animals, not just birds, but mammals and perhaps reptiles and amphibians that you're going to be able to attract, and your property is going to become functional or useful for these animals throughout the year.
Very good information. Ruth in Madison has a question for you. Let's go there. Ruth, hi.
Hi. This is perfect timing for this call. I live near the Arboretum, and I'm on the university side of the Arboretum, not the Beltline side of the Arboretum. And in the spring, the turtles come across the street on Arbor Drive to lay their eggs. We have neighbors who feel that they should pick up any of the little turtles when they hatch if they get hung up somewhere on this side of the street and carry them back to the other side of the street by Honium Pond. What are your thoughts on that? I say, don't touch them.
So and we let in with this too. Wildlife, they know what they're doing. You know, they have these innate abilities and instincts and adaptations to live, you know, in the wild. And so what we tell people with turtles crossing roads is always, if you're going to intervene to help with the safety of that turtle crossing a road, your safety has to be priority. It can't be on the Beltline stopping to help a turtle. It's just not safe. A rural crunchy road, if you can put your hazards on and pull over far enough to help that turtle, I think that's a reasonable thing to do. But put the turtle on the side of the road it was heading towards. Don't turn it around. Again, they know where they're trying to go. And at different times of the year, they're going to wetlands, and other times they're moving back into the upland areas. So as far as hatchlings, turtles of our 12 species, 5 are threatened or endangered. They have a lot of risks, whether that be road mortality, whether it be predation on the nest. So lots of, you know, even from domestic animals all the way to raccoons and possum and crow, they have a, you know, it's a heavy lift to pull off a nest. That being said, in an urban area, I still would be tempted first to let nature take its course, let wildlife do what they, you know, do. But if it was in a safety situation, and you are trying to, you know, keep them from a neighbor's dog that you know is loose or things like that, I guess I would start by maybe, again, making a phone call to a rehabilitator or the biologist or, you know, somebody knowledgeable just to ask what they think in that particular situation. I don't want to say it's never a good case, but, you know, if you're worried about the safety or the likelihood of survival for those hatchlings, you may intervene in an urban setting, but otherwise I'd be tempted to just let things play out.
The one thing I might add on to Jamie, I agree with what Jamie's saying. The one thing I might add on is if you have the ability to make some signs or work with the city to make some signs, if that is a seasonal area where they move across the road, it might not be a bad idea to put up a turtle crossing sign or something like that, just to alert drivers. And there's a lot of wonderful apps out there that people communicate with through their neighborhoods, such as Facebook or Nextdoor or something like that. And it might not be a bad idea to put out just a post that turtles are moving across the roadways. Please be careful. Not only if you hit a pretty good sized snapping turtle, it can send your front end alignment out of whack pretty quickly. But also, you know, we don't want to be running over turtles because, as Jamie mentioned, that there's a number of them that are becoming more and more rare, and we need to protect those populations. But if you can put up some signage or work with the city, especially if that's a known travel corridor, that would be probably a pretty good idea as well.
Yeah, good points. Ruth, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. David Drake and Jamie Knack, our guests today. Great to have them here to talk about wildlife, you can join in too. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or phone in at 1-800-642-1234. Jill Nadeau, our producer, Christina Myshock, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Looking at the world of wildlife today with our Extension Wildlife Specialist and Professor David Drake and Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist Jamie Knack. Thanks for joining in. I want to get back to birds for just a minute, because one of the things I wanted to mention was, or have you talk about, was the Great Wisconsin Birdathon. David, do you want to talk about that a little bit? Give us the insights.
Yeah, sure. I'd be glad to, Larry. Thank you. And thank you for featuring this wonderful program. So this is an annual birding program that's been going on for maybe the last 10 years or so, started by the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin. So it's essentially an opportunity for people who are passionate about birds, and you don't have to be an experienced birder to participate. But between now and June 15th, the idea is that you would either form a team or you could do it individually as well. But it's a fundraising event to support bird habitat, and especially those birds that are somewhat in peril as a population. So some of the endangered species like Kirtland's warblers, whooping cranes, piping plovers, and some other species that are not doing as well from a population status. And so essentially you would either on your own or as a team, you would approach friends, family, community, neighbors, whatever the case is, and you would ask them to kind of sponsor you. So based on the number of birds you find over a 24-hour period, they would perhaps say, all right, for every bird you find, I'll give you a dollar or 50 cents or whatever the case might be. And it's essentially a fundraising event. And it's a way to combine people's passion for birding, an opportunity for people to go out and kind of do an inventory of the birds that are nearby, a way to educate the public about birds and some of the conservation needs of avian species and things like that. So between now and June 15th, you can organize a team, fundraise. You have essentially a 24-hour period to go out and find as many birds as you possibly can. And with all these birding events, it's kind of an honor system. So, you know, if you put down that I found 722 species in the state of Wisconsin, we know you're lying, because there's only about 400 of them. But you know, in a good day, especially if you're an experienced birder and you can get around, or you hit a hot spot when you're hitting migration just right, you know, you might be able to find 150 to 200 bird species. So that's about half of what we have in the state of Wisconsin, which is a pretty remarkable 24 hours if you can pull that off. But it's just a fun opportunity, and you can identify the birds either by sight or by their call, by sound. And then as you identify them, you put them down on a bird list and then approach the people who sponsored you and just say, hey, I found, you know, 100 birds and here's how much you owe me. And then they'll collect the donations and they'll donate one lump sum per team or per individual to the Natural Resources Foundation. And just as an example, since the Natural Resources Foundation has been doing the Birdathon, they've raised over $500,000 doing this, and that all goes to support avian conservation. And last year, in 2020, which was an unusual year, obviously, because of the COVID situation, the Natural Resources Foundation raised $104,000 through this Birdathon. So that's a pretty remarkable money.
Yeah, that is really, really great. And again, how do people get involved in it?
Yeah, probably the best thing to do is either Google or use a search engine on the internet for Wisconsin Birdathon, or you could also Google or use a search engine for Wisconsin Natural Resources Foundation, and you'll find it either way.
All right. Ann in Madison, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Ann.
Hi. I have a chipmunk problem I'd like some solutions to. I have two burrows. One goes under my front walk near the house. The other one undermines my wooden shed.
Okay.
Could you help me about that?
Sure.
And is it a small, is this like a half dollar size or dollar size hole?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so the two species that are possibilities here are the 13-line ground squirrel, which most folks will refer to as a gopher, or the chipmunk, and there are two species, with the eastern chipmunk being the most common. Chipmunks tend to prefer a little bit more of a wooded edge or wooded habitat nearby. The ground squirrels are in more open grassland areas, like on golf courses and certainly in people's lawns. So I don't doubt that you have one of those two with the description that you provided and the location of those holes. To be very honest, those are species that are common. And we go through battles with them, every couple of years. Certainly tolerate having a few in the yard, but all of a sudden they start to undermine your rock foundations or your rock walls and sidewalks, like you mentioned. And we really, you know, you don't want that to continue. You certainly don't want to try to roust them out by putting a garden hose down, because you'll continue to displace the soil there. If you let those burrows continue and you drive something heavy over that sidewalk, you run the risk of breaking that concrete. So it is something you probably need to intervene with. And the easiest thing really is lethal control in this situation. And so using a large snap trap, so just like you'd use in the house for mice, but one for rats, baited with a little bit of peanut butter, leveled so it's not tippy, and placed right next to that hole, will often catch that ground squirrel or chipmunk pretty quickly. And then you can backfill that dirt and kind of monitor to see if it's been reopened. But hopefully by just removing an animal or two, you can solve that problem. Another thing to be aware of is that ground birds can sometimes be attracted to that if you're using a mixed peanut butter and seed. And so you can put a box over the top of that trap, or if you have domestic animals you're concerned about, and just leave an opening on one end that the ground squirrels will come in, but birds won't usually hop into a hole. You can take steps to minimize risks to non-targets in that situation. You certainly can do poisonous baits or toxins as well. I guess, you know, in this case, my personal preference would be to just lethally remove them rather than using a gas cartridge or a poison where that animal's carcass could be in the area too. So, and then other things you can do, I mean, if it's in a garden situation, certainly fencing can help with that. If you're in the process of building a landscaping wall, you can be proactive in putting some mesh behind the rocks to prevent them from burrowing in those rock walls to begin with. So there's certainly some steps you can take to be proactive. And for more information, we have a wildlife ecology and damage management website with Extension, and there's a fact sheet on ground squirrels.
Yeah, web address if you want.
Yeah, please do, David.
Yeah, so we just changed the server on it. So it's wildlifedamage.cals.wisc.edu. So wildlifedamage.cals.wisc, the first four letters of Wisconsin, .edu, the first three letters of education.
We'll try to post that up on our page as well, on the Larry Mueller Show page, so people can get to it if they didn't get it written down.
Great. Thank you.
There you go. Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Ann. Appreciate it very much. Marion in Wisconsin Rapids, your turn. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for putting me on. I just wanted to make a comment about the lady that talked about the turtle crossing the road.
Yeah.
I lived several years ago. I lived in Germany, and there the problem was with frogs. And the government put up fences along the sides of the roads with little gaps, and people would stop and carry the frogs across the road toward the pond. Otherwise, if the frogs kept crossing the road and nobody carried them across, the cars hit them quite frequently, and they became a danger because the roads would get so slippery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
David, you're quite familiar with that.
Yeah, I've seen that before. Some places are experimenting with under road culvert crossings. So essentially, they will put up fencing so that they can kind of guide the animals, in particular salamanders, frogs, turtles, whatever the case might be, to these culverts that they'll put under the road, and then the animals can go under the culvert, through the culvert, under the road safely. And so that's actually worked out pretty well. I know that some of those culverts, they have to have some kind of a lighting system or opaque roof to the culvert, so the animals, if it's pitch black, they're a little bit reluctant to go through there. So they'd like to have some light in there. But that is, and what you describe that you saw in Germany, that is hopefully becoming more and more common, so we can help these animals get either under or across the roads more safely, both for the animal and for the driver.
Yeah. Thanks, Marion. Appreciate it. Dawn in La Crosse, it's your turn. Hi, Dawn.
Hi, great show.
Thank you.
The other day I was driving in kind of a rural area south of Marshfield, and I saw a group of deer, maybe seven or eight, and among them was one that was all white. It was just gorgeous. And I'm just wondering how rare that is.
So what you saw would be, so there's a couple different color phases in deer. It could be if they're true albinos, they're all white with pink eyes, pink nose, that would be a true albino. We also have situations where parts of their body are white, or and other parts are brown, and we call that piebald. And so it's not uncommon. It I don't know if I have a percentage to give you what percent of the population exhibit either of those characteristics, but it's a genetic recessive trait. And so what we see is there tends to be certain areas in the state, and I'm sure callers or listeners can attest to this, that there's certain areas, like Boulder Junction always comes to mind, where there seems to be a fair number of white deer, because it is in the genetic traits of that particular, population of deer. And so I pay attention to the Wisconsin Outdoor News. There's always pictures and trail camera photos, posted in there. You see them on Facebook posts as well. So yeah, special animals, unique. Not super uncommon to come across them, depending on where you are in the state. So
yeah,
cool sighting.
I should mention too, sure.
deer are going through their molt right now. And David, I don't know if you've gotten calls, but people that still have trail cameras out or are driving around and seeing deer, we often get reports that a deer looks like it may have mange or it has an injury. And a lot of times what that is the deer is losing its heavy winter coat, so that brown, thick coat. And now what's underneath or what's coming in is a real reddish and shorter, reddish-colored coat that's much shorter. And so sometimes they look, they're in the transition period as they go through that mold. Yeah. They might look a little rough, but rest assured they're healthy.
All right, and I've already gotten some requests for a repeat of that address that you gave. You want to give that another time or two?
Yep, I'd be glad to. So it's wildlife damage, all one word. So wildlife damage dot WI, or excuse me, wildlife damage dot cals dot WISC dot EDU. So wildlife damage dot CALS dot WISC. Dot edu.
Okay. So there we go.
That website has a bunch of information on dealing with wildlife damage. By understanding the animal's ecology, why it's causing the damage, you can better address it. But a number of fact sheets also talks about laws and regulations related to nuisance wildlife. So I encourage you to take a look.
Yeah, and I'm seeing now Jill's getting that up right now on the Larry Mueller Show page and WPR.org/Larry. Most people remember that one. Just go to the program notes and you'll find it there for today's show, that is. All right, John in Sturgeon Bay, it's your turn. Hi, John.
Hi, good morning. Say, comment and a question. The last few springs, just after ice out, we would be fishing and trolling out on Green Bay for walleyes and brown trout, and we often had seen long-tailed ducks, I think the old politically incorrect name was the old squaw, but they're really cool to see. But this year we saw literally thousands of birds. And what is interesting is we duck hunt quite a bit, and especially we hunt diving ducks, and we never see them in the fall anywhere around there. And I looked them up, and I don't know really their story other than I don't think they're really supposed to be in this area that much. But I also saw they were the deepest diving duck maybe on the planet, like 200 feet they've dove before. So what can you tell us about that? It's a fascinating-looking duck.
Yeah. All right. Jamie, do you want to take over?
Sure. So those I had Wisconsin eBird. So I'm gonna throw another website at you. It's a really great time of the year, fall and spring, to kind of have that website up because you can track migration. So you can go to the Wisconsin eBird website, go into explore species data. You can set a time frame. So right now I said, I want to look from March to May of this year, this current year. And I want to see what migration looks like or what sightings look like. So I've not seen my first ruby-throated hummingbird yet. I had the orioles this weekend, but not the hummingbirds. And they should be here any day now. And you can see on that map then, you can see like the southern third of the state, lots of reports of hummingbirds, and they're slowly making their way north. Those diving ducks that the caller referenced, when you look at the long-tailed duck right now, you'll see there's reports all up and down Lake Michigan. So, certainly they're migrating along that, particular habitat or that feature of the lake. And so it might just be they're out deeper than when you're hunting them. And so on. But I think if you spent time on some of the local birding pages or discussion boards, you'll see that people are in fact seeing them. I see reports, from Chicago on up to Sturgeon Bay.
I think, cool. The spring too, the spring migration is a more contracted migration period. So the birds, that migration period in the spring is much shorter than it is in the fall. And the birds are very anxious to get back up under their breeding grounds, set breeding territories, and start breeding because they have a small window in the summer before they have to turn around and head back south. So it's more common to see a lot of birds in a very concentrated clump in the spring than it is in the fall, which in the fall, that breeding or that migration period is much longer and it's drawn out over a couple of months versus over maybe 6 weeks. And so that might be also one of the reasons that you're seeing such big rafts of ducks right now versus in the fall time.
Yeah, another good point. Thank you very much for that comment and question. Tom in Green Bay, we turn to you. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Hopefully it's a quick question. You were talking about the chipmunks and the ground squirrels. And my family won't let me kill them. So I've been live trapping them. Last year I tracked, I quit counting at 35. I take them and I drive miles from the house to release them. And I'm wondering, how far do I have to go so they don't come back to my house?
Tom, it's a great discussion point, right? So we oftentimes struggle with killing an animal. We want to give that animal another chance. So we don't want it in our backyard, but we also don't want to kill it. And I get that, right? That's part of human emotion and sentiment and so on. But there's concern over capturing an animal and releasing it somewhere else. And some would argue that that's not necessarily humane either, because that animal now has to compete with species of its own kind, avoid predation, find cover, find food. It's like us getting picked up and dropped off in the middle of Chicago and having to find our way. So there's that argument. By state law, you cannot capture and relocate an animal without permission of the property owner. So we get this a lot where people will take a tree squirrel from the backyard and take it down to the county park or a state park. And you legally can't do that without permission. if you have a landowner that you know and they're happy to have you release chipmunks or woodchucks, we see it a lot, that's not a problem. You just have to have permission for the landowner or the property manager. And part of that is we're also trying to reduce the risk of spreading diseases. We think about a raccoon in the city, perhaps it has a disease and we may be moving that disease around the landscape. So there's a lot of good reasons not to relocate animals and to really work to address the problem in general. So it may be there's some habitat modifications around the yard that you can make, whether it's excluding them with hardware cloth from being able to make the burrows where they want to make the burrows. You might look at food sources. For example, if you're feeding wild birds and you have a lot of spilled seed on the ground, that's a pretty nice place for chipmunks and ground squirrels to hang out. So maybe you stop feeding the birds or you're more frequently cleaning up that spilled seed. And other things would just, you know, removing brush piles, or if you have a wood pile, you know, places where they're seeking shelter or cover. And so there might be some things you can do to manipulate that area to keep them at bay without having to lethally remove them.
Yeah, good points. Thank you very much, Tom, for calling. Appreciate your call. David Drake, Extension Wildlife Specialist, and Professor Jamie Nack, Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist, our guest today. Questions or experiences to share? Give a call at 800-642-1234, or you can email us a question or maybe send a photo to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mealer. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network as we take a look at the world of wildlife in our state with David Drake and Jamie Nack. Always great to have them come by. And lots of callers online. We've got an email or two coming in. I wanted to mention, though, or have you comment on the loon emergency last week. It was something that I saw quite a story about it, and it was... It was fascinating to me. David, are you up on that story?
Yeah.
We had loons just literally falling out of the air.
Falling out of the sky. It is a very interesting story for sure. So the type of loon that we're talking about is a common loon. We occasionally get red-throated loons here, but very rarely. So the common loon is the one that's obviously the most common loon we have in the state. Up in the northern part of the state in the lakes, you know, all black and white. Big bird, it's a fish eating bird. So they were migrating. They migrate from down south up into the northern part of the United States, up into Canada for the summer. And last week, as they were migrating through one night, they hit some kind of wintry weather up in the upper environment, and their wings literally iced up to the point where they were so heavy with ice on their wings, they couldn't fly any longer. They literally fell out of the sky. And so people were finding them occasionally in their fields or in some smaller ponds and things like that. And it's somewhat similar to if you are on an airplane taking off out of Minneapolis or Milwaukee or Madison or something like that, and we have wintry weather, a lot of times before the plane takes off, they'll go through a de-icing process where a de-icing or kind of an antifreeze will be sprayed on the wings to prevent the wings from accumulating ice as they fly up in the upper environment. And so if you don't do that, the wings get heavy and the plane will actually fall out of the sky. And so that's what happened with these loons, is not only did their wings ice over, so they weren't as usable as if their wings don't have ice, but they also gained some weight and they couldn't carry that extra weight. And so it caused them to fall out of the sky. Now, the problem with loons is because they're a relatively heavy bird and their feet are set far enough back on their body or relatively far back in their body compared to some other birds, because they're a very strong swimming bird and a very fast swimming bird, so they catch fish under the water, that if loons are on land, they really can't walk. They can't support themselves on their legs and walk across the land like a robin, for example. So they kind of have to prop themselves on their wings and move across the land as they kind of propel themselves on their wings, or wing walk, which is not very efficient and very costly from an energy standpoint. And if they fall into some of these smaller ponds, because they're such a heavy-bodied bird, they need a bit of a runway to be able to get up and off that water and get enough air flowing across their wings so they can actually take flight. So on those smaller ponds, they might be okay in terms of floating on the water and be able to feed, but they can't get off that smaller pond because they don't have enough runway to take off. And so people in around the Antigo area, in some communities around Antigo, were finding loons that had literally fallen out of the sky and were either stuck on these small ponds or stuck in these fields. And people were going to collect the loons and bringing them to a wildlife rehabilitator up in Antigo. And they were taking a look at the loons and assessing them, their health, and releasing the ones they could and nursing back to health the ones that they needed to. But apparently they were putting a vast, large amount of order for suckers and minnows. And they were putting these loons yeah. into small pools with the minnows, and that's how they were rehabbing the loons and allowing the loons to feed. So it was a pretty interesting story, and hopefully it's going to have a good ending for all the loons that fall out of the sky.
Diane in Hubbleton, your turn. Hi, thanks for calling.
Thank you for such a wonderful, timely program. We live out in the country, and 20 years ago, it was very common for me to look out my window and see fox. And we have a hill across the field where I would see them sunning by their, I guess, their dens. Then they stopped, and we had coyotes. Now, the past 2 years, I've seen the dens on the hill, but I have not seen any fox. When would I expect to see them laying out sunning, and when would their babies be coming?
Well, so what you're seeing there is kind of this interplay between fox and coyotes. And in non-urban areas, coyotes typically will exclude red fox. Coyotes are about three times the size of a red fox, and red fox and coyotes will overlap in the types of habitat that they use, and to some extent in the types of the food that they'll actually use. And so in areas where you have limiting quantities of habitat or what they need to live, and specifically food, so in non-urban type areas, coyotes, because they're the larger of the two species, will typically exclude fox from using that area. And if the fox don't observe that, coyotes will actually kill them. And not kill them to eat them, but just to kill them to limit competition. And what you were describing, where you were seeing fox and then the coyotes moved in and then you didn't see fox, that's exactly what happens in these non-urban areas, is that as the coyotes come in, they kind of have the run of the land, if you will, because they're the larger of the two species, and they'll exclude the red fox from that area. And so that's what you're seeing. You're probably seeing either very few fox or no fox at all in your area, and that's why you're not seeing many of them at all.
David, and then she was asking about timing for
deliveries. Yeah, so for fox, it really depends. We monitor red fox here in the city of Madison, and we have fox that have been denning and actually giving birth as early as late February, which is about a month earlier than normal in non-urban areas. So out in the country, probably mid-March would be the earliest, late March, something like that for fox, and about another month later for coyotes.
All right, there we go. So, and they would still be going and birthing another month, for over a month or so?
Well, yeah, so the fox will, when they birth, it's like having a litter of dogs, right? So that they'll have that litter all on the same day. But the coyotes typically will give birth to their pups about a month or so later, 2 to 4 weeks later, than fox give birth to their kits.
All right, there you go, Diane. Thank you so much. Donna in Greendale, it's your turn. Hi, Donna.
Hi there. We have an incident where we have a camera that caught a great horned owl killing a duck in our garden, and there's now 13 little eggs in there. What to do?
So so I'm guessing species-wise, likelihood we're talking about a mallard. Would you happen to know if it looked like a hen mallard, or you can tell the difference between drakes and hens? Do you have a feeling?
It was a mallard.
Okay. So a couple of things you can do. You could put a couple of pieces of vegetation, light vegetation, some grasses or some twigs across that nest. Okay, so if you see the eggs, there would have been a bowl of down that the mother duck would cover the eggs with anytime she left to go feed and take a break. So first of all, make sure the eggs are covered, and then put some long grasses or twigs in a crisscross pattern, and give it 24, give it some time to see if she returns back to the nest, and a couple of hours. And in the meantime, I would call a wildlife rehabilitator in your area. Again, you can get that directory from going to the DNR website, type in Keep Wildlife Wild. And then on the right-hand side of that homepage, there'll be a link to contact a rehabilitator. And so look for one in your area, and you can inquire with them. I don't honestly know how many would take eggs and incubate them. And so this might be a case where, there isn't any more you can do at this point. Those eggs, we often wouldn't take them and put them in another nest or anything like that. And if mom's not there, nobody else is really going to be there to incubate them. So the best you can do is let's confirm whether they're being attended, and then call a wildlife rehabilitator to see if they are aware of anybody that would take those eggs and attempt to incubate them.
I'll give you an alternative option, and that's just to leave the nest as is, because those eggs will feed other animals such as, fox, skunk, raccoons, possum. And I get that that's not always the most attractive option for people, but everything needs to eat. And if it is a mallard duck, that population of, mallards is not hurting at all. So likely the population will be just fine. And even though it's unfortunate for those 13 eggs, and those 13 ducklings, but it may benefit other species that need to eat for that day.
That's another good point. Thank you, Donna, for calling. Appreciate it. Well, Karen in Oshkosh, what's on your mind?
Hi, yeah. Back in the late 50s, early 60s, my dad kept catching a squirrel that was aggravating the bird feeders, and he'd catch it, he'd drive it away. My mom said, "You're just catching the same squirrel." He says, "I am not." And in those days, there was a popular product that women used that was, you could either spray gold or silver or red streaks in your hair. So she went inside, got her gold hairspray, sprayed the squirrel. My dad drove it 10, 20, 12 miles away, past a creek, thinking this thing is never going to get back. 3 days later, the gold squirrel showed up again.
Yeah. It is amazing how they hone in on an area and how they're able to come back. I'm always amazed with waterfowl and so on, where they're coming back, or birds, coming back and nesting in the same areas, how they find your backyard year after year.
Well, thanks for that story, Karen. Appreciate it. Steve in Richfield, hi.
Hi there. Quick comment and then a question. My comment was, I'd like to address the fact that possums are very beneficial, in as much as they eat so many ticks in a season, and are virtually immune to rabies. And my question is, I'd always heard that if you find a baby possum, that the mother is unaware that that possum's dropped off. And then you should actually pick it up and get it to a rehabber. Is that true?
That's a good question.
Go on, Jamie.
Well, I will definitely concur with you. All wildlife have a role in the system. There's certainly fabulous scavengers, and there is some research on the benefits they have in terms of that they will eat ticks. I was just, I don't think I have it in front of me, but on this Keeping Wildlife Wild website, there is a thing there on possums. So they're a marsupial, our only marsupial. Babies are born and they crawl into the mother's pouch. When they're born, they're about the size of a jelly bean. And they spend a number of days and weeks getting larger, to the point where I want to say it was about 6 inches, 8 inches or so, where they're able to crawl out And sometimes they even cling on mom's back and they might be with her. But what I remember just reading recently here was at the time that they're out of the pouch and starting to move around on their own, they can be pretty independent of mom. So this is a situation, again, where I'd hesitate to just pick up that possum if it's outside of her pouch. It's different if mom got attacked by a domestic dog or a coyote or hit by a car and you discover young in the pouch. They need help. But a possum that's 8 inches or so and moving around on its own, maybe near mom, but on its own, is likely capable of surviving, or mom's still in the area and coming back out.
Jamie, I'm just looking at that right now. So the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, the Keep Wildlife campaign, is suggesting if you find a possum that is cold, wet, injured, or in a dangerous location, or is less than 7 inches long, not including the tail, so 7 inches from the nose to the end of the body, it may need to be placed in the care of a licensed wildlife rehabilitator. If you find a young possum and it is longer than 9 inches from snout to rump, or from nose to end of the body, it is old enough to be independent of its mother. So 7 inches or 9 inches seems to be the threshold.
Yeah. And again, mom will come back. She'll come back to her young and move them. So it can be a wait and see approach. Wait for an hour, monitor it, see what happens, and then call.
David Drake and Jamie Nack will be with us right up till 12:30 today, talking wildlife. We will take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And then we'll be back with our guests. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at wildlife today with our two guests, Jamie Nack and David Drake. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today. Jamie, Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist. David's an Extension Wildlife Specialist and professor, both affiliated with the Division of Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. So questions for them or maybe experiences to share, give a call at 800-642-1234. Email us to ideas@wpr.org. And all this talk about babies, I was reminded last week we talked with the editor of Our Wisconsin magazine. And in the April-May issue, they have a story with several photos of loon parents who took a mallard duckling under their wing as their own and raised it. As the duckling got bigger, it got so heavy that the loon was actually I don't know if I can show you guys if you can see it or not. The loon is almost sinking. but the loon took on some of the habits, or the mallard took on some of the habits of the loon, and the loons took on some of the habits of the mallard. It's a fascinating story in Our Wisconsin magazine. It happened in 2019. You guys may have already been aware of it, but I was not. It's that April-May issue. Jamie, were you familiar with that?
Yep, I knew of it. I think we made a quick mention of it on a radio program last spring. What is really fascinating is that loons are a fish-eating species. As David mentioned earlier, they're a diving duck. They dive, deep underwater. Mallards are dabbling ducks. They're more, foraging on the surface, and that they can, accommodate or, still be associated with each other. And it was pretty well documented. I know there were local folks who were keeping tabs on it, but I don't know the final story. So that gives me a good reason to go search out that article and see how things ended up.
It's a great piece. And the mallard was taking minnows from the mom and dad were giving her. But then they also started going along the shoreline, which they normally don't do because the baby mallard was going in there. So that's a great story. I just had to bring that up. Mike in Fond du Lac, what's on your mind? Hi, Mike.
Hi, guys. This one I'm very interested in, and I'll take my answer off the air. particularly Vernon County, but the entire southwest Wisconsin, why has the turkey population just about disappeared? Is it farming practices, or is it just predators? Because they're in big pockets in the state, but my friend's land in Vernon County, that whole area, which was premier at one time, is just void of birds. So if you can answer that, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that's something that's up in the air, but a lot of people have been noting that in some areas. Now, where I hunt, there's plenty there, but that's east of what you're talking about.
He was saying turkeys, right? I was having a hard time.
Yeah, turkeys. Yeah, turkeys.
So, you know, the one thing I'm not familiar specifically with that, I know the area, I'm not familiar specifically with the turkey population down there, but the one thing I'm would guess is that in the southwest part of the state, there are some forestry collectives down there or landowner cooperatives down there, and they've done a very, very nice job of managing forest land to the point where they have actually pretty healthy forests. And we can't say that in other parts of the state of Wisconsin. We can't say that across the eastern part of the United States because there's overabundant deer populations, and those deer populations essentially will completely devegetate or eat through the forest understory. And turkeys like to see long distances because they like to see the predators coming at them from a long ways away. So turkeys can obviously fly, but they'll start running away first before they start flying away. And I'm wondering down in the southwest part of the state where they are doing a really nice job of forest health, if they don't have healthy understories, midstories, and upper canopies, and maybe that understory is so thick that those turkeys just don't feel comfortable in there, or there's just not an open enough understory habitat that the turkeys are in there in pockets like they are in other parts of the state.
That's interesting. I hadn't heard that, so I'm glad to hear that, David. It's certainly sounds like it makes a lot of sense to me. Let me just put it that way. So something to consider, Mike. Thank you for calling. Katie emailed that her sister has a big muskrat network of tunnels along her lake shoreline in Oconomowoc, and wondering if there's a way for filling in or keeping them from coming back, the muskrats.
So I'll take that one. So muskrats are an aquatic rodent. They're an animal that is obviously in the water year-round. They're active year-round, even through the wintertime. They'll operate under the ice and things like that. Muskrats will den in a couple different ways. If you're in a cattail marsh, they will completely denude that cattail marsh, and they'll eat all the cattails and create muskrat houses. Other areas, they may actually bank den, so they'll actually dig holes into the bank and then use those burrows as their dens. And it sounds like that's what's going on here. So there's a couple of different things you can do. You can trap them if you want to, and you can live trap them or you can kill trap them. If you're interested in kill trapping them, you might want to reach out to the Wisconsin Trappers Association if you're not comfortable trapping them yourself, and see if a trapper in your area would be interested in coming out and perhaps trapping your property. Now, a trapper probably is not going to be interested right now because the fur is not prime or it's not a valuable coat right now like it will be in the wintertime. But in the winter, they might be interested in coming out. If you are looking for something that's non-lethal, so you're not interested in killing the animal, you are probably going to have to get the animals out of there to begin with in some capacity. But the other thing you can do is you can put riprap in there. So take rock, and you would just pack your shoreline with rock. Or you can take kind of like a hurricane fencing material or chain link fence material, and you can actually put that down on your shoreline and stake that down. Now, depending on your access issues to go from your property into the water, rock riprap and chain link fence isn't the best thing to walk across with bare feet in the summertime, or if you're trying to create a beach situation or something like that. But those would be some of the suggestions, either to trap them either as a live trap or kill trap, and or exclude them in some capacity, either using rock or chain link fence.
All right, there we go. Tim in New Berlin, your turn. Hi, Tim.
Hi. Yeah, I live in New Berlin, and for the first time in several years, we had a couple deer in our yard today. And I know why. It's because they are building this massive, the biggest big box store I've ever seen in my life, on a former patch of green space and woods and pasture. And this is not good for the deer. It's not good for the people. It spreads ticks. It's not good for anybody. In places like Pewaukee, it's even worse. You can't even have an arborvita in some of the neighborhoods in Pewaukee because the deer browse, and you can't blame them for that. Now, is there awareness of this problem and this issue and anything that is underway to address this? Do you know of?
Address the loss of green space for wildlife, essentially, is
no,
what
I mean,
you're saying.
Address how do we manage the wildlife now? I mean, I don't.
Oh, I got
I'm not optimistic enough to think that New Berlin is going to reverse themselves on development. I wish they would. But what do this isn't good for the deer from a wildlife management point of view. Is there anything that's being discussed to do something about this?
Well, I will address that question. So you're not unique in New Berlin, obviously. The entire United States is being developed, and even though about 85% of the United States human population lives in an urban area, that urban area only takes up about 10% of the entire American footprint. So, or the footprint of that urban area only takes up about 10% of the American landmass. So it is concentrated. So just to put that in perspective. The other issue is, even though the big box store is going in, deer will do just fine, as will most of the other urban wildlife species you see, like raccoons and crows and turkeys and even sandhill cranes and Canada geese and things like that, because they're very adaptable, and they actually thrive in a lot of these fragmented landscapes that we create for them as we develop the landscape for a human population. We are doing a lot of more monitoring and research on urban populations, and are pretty surprised at how adaptable and how stubborn wildlife are, that they can actually do quite well in a variety of different types of urban development. And so I understand what you're saying, and it is sometimes disturbing to see all this land developed for human purposes. But from a wildlife standpoint, there's a vast majority, diverse abundance of species that can do quite well living amongst the human population. So I wouldn't be overly concerned about it. You know, some of the species you might want to be concerned about would be things like grassland songbirds and some of the neotropical migratory songbirds we've already talked about, like warblers and buntings and things like that. Some of the amphibians like salamanders don't do as well around urban areas. But there are a lot of species that are urban adapted, much more so than we ever thought. Sandhill cranes is a good example. Badgers is an example where badgers are starting to live on the outskirts of suburban urban type areas. So I think the jury is still out on what these urban areas look like and what types of wildlife can live amongst the human population. And we'll continue to monitor that and continue to research that.
But what does Tim do in terms of his own place?
Well, it sounds like he doesn't mind having the deer in his yard. I think it depends on your perspective. If you're a gardener or you enjoy gardening for vegetables or landscaping in your yard, a lot of people don't like the deer simply because they are so destructive in terms of the browsing or eating of the vegetation. In that case, you're somewhat limited because you are not able to harvest the deer in the urban areas. So you really are limited to fencing them out of your yard or fencing them out of the garden area or the landscape area where you don't want them to browse. But if you don't mind them being in your yard, enjoy watching them and study them and just enjoy having them there.
Jamie, it might be a good time to bring up, sort of related here, woodland wildlife management program for private landowners. This certainly doesn't sound like Tim's area, but what he's addressing, but it reminded me I should ask you about it.
Well, Larry, I really appreciate you giving me the time to put a plug in here for a program that both David and Scott Craven, who's on Wednesdays on months opposite of us. So the three of us get to work on this program together. It's called the Wisconsin Coverts Project. It's spelled covert, but pronounced covert, which is a English term that describes a dense thicket of cover for wildlife. I didn't come up with the name. I would have probably chose something different, but that's the meaning behind the Wisconsin Coverts Project. And so I guess, you know, our interest in being involved in this program is there. Wisconsin has 16 million acres of forest land cover. 57% of that area is owned and managed by individuals or families, so private woodland owners. They're responsible for caring for 10 million acres of woodlands in the state. Now, wildlife, in our role as extension specialists, wildlife is a public resource that resides on both public land and private land. And so we want to make sure that we are getting information out and educating private landowners on what their options are. We do not have a goal of managing specifically for deer or early successional forest management. We want to get landowners in for this workshop. It's a Thursday through a Sunday. We take a cohort of about 25 to 30 landowners every August. And it's an intensive workshop. We bring in some phenomenal professionals in both forestry and wildlife management to talk to you about how do you do a timber sale on your property? How do you manage for small mammals? How do you manage for reptiles and amphibians? How about songbird management? Invasive plant species management? We go on a field tour of the Northern Highlands American Legion State Forest, where we have a forester and a wildlife biologist taking us into stands of trees with different silvicultural harvest structures going on to meet a different wildlife objective. And so we're getting you in the classroom, on the ground, to show you options that you can apply on your own woodland property, help you with understanding the importance of having a written management plan, making sure your goals are reasonable and attainable for the species you're interested in. We may all want 100 grouse per acre, but for grouse, you know, a pair per 10 acres is reasonable. So it's a great program. Again, it's an overnight program, and there is a lot of opportunity for peer-to-peer learning. And we hear that time and time again on the evaluations, how much people learn from other landowners or get inspired by work that somebody else has done. In addition to the educational content we're providing, we also are able to point you, and Extension does a great job of this, pointing you to resources in terms of people, cost share assistance programs, websites, publications, where you can get more information. Again, all to help you make an informed decision based on the goals you have for your property. So with that being said, I'd encourage you to just do an internet search for the Wisconsin Coverts Project. And you'll see information there on how to apply. We do an application process because we want to make sure, you know, we're working with landowners who are invested in developing a plan and working on their property. Applications are due June 15th of every year. This year's workshop is August 12th to the 15th. We love to hold our workshops at Kemp Natural Resources Station, which is one of UW-Madison's agricultural research stations in Woodruff, Wisconsin. This is a partnership between our department, the Division of Extension. The Rough Grouse Society has been involved since the beginning in 1994. We have a number of past coverts cooperators who provide funds to keep the program going. And most recently, we've been recipients of a Sustainable Forestry Initiative grants program to keep this program going. So there's no cost for the people who are accepted to attend. We've had 770 cooperators go through the program and have made some great strides in terms of impacting their own properties, but also just excellent sources of information in their own communities. Kind of, again, that peer-to-peer network of sharing information with other landowners. So I am super hopeful that COVID and guidelines, CDC guidelines, Division of Extension guidelines, are going to make it possible for us to host this program in August. We did have to cancel last August as a result of COVID. My hope is to get all of the, you know, to get the applications, pull this off. If by some reason we can't, we will roll those applications over to the following year. But I remain hopeful that we're going to be able to have a Covert's workshop this August. Again, August 12th to the 15th, applications are on that website. And you're also more than welcome to email me directly.
And the website again is?
Again, besides giving a long website address, I would just do a search for Wisconsin Covert's Project. It'll be your first item that comes up under that search.
All right, there we go. A good friend of mine, old friend of mine, Kurt Westbrook, applied and was accepted in that program. He loved that program and still talks about it. It's been quite a few years now, but,
well, and but Larry, he learned a lot. Once you go through the program, we hold a reunion / advanced training every 5 years. And that's also due this August. And I tell you, cooperators are asking me all the time, when's the next reunion? When's the next reunion? So I'm also very excited to host that this August as well. So it's a good group of people for a good cause.
A good group of people for a good cause. Just to switch gears, I wanted to mention summer. It's an important time for bats. And just in the last minute or two, we can comment on that.
Yep. So thank you, Larry, for bringing that up. We've got 8 bat species in the state of Wisconsin, 4 of which are resident bat species. So they hibernate through the winter. We've got 4 that are migratory, and they'll fly out of our area for the winter and then fly back up here. The bats that we are primarily concerned about are the 4 resident species, because those are the 4 that are susceptible to white nose syndrome. So there's a state law that says between June 1st and August 15th, you cannot exclude bats from your attic. And primarily that would be most likely little brown bats and big brown bats, because those are the 2 species that are most commonly denning in somebody's attic or in their house. And the reason you cannot exclude the bats in between June 1st and August 15th, because we do not want you to separate the mom who is nursing her pups. We don't want her to be separated from the pups. And so if you exclude her, she can go out the one-way exclusion door, for example, and can't get back in. The pups are stuck inside because they're not able to fly yet. And when they're stuck inside and they can't be nursed, then they're doomed to death. And so we want to be careful of that, because the bat populations need all the help they can get right now for sustainability.
So people could still exclude until June 1st.
Until June 1st. So if you have bats in your house or your walls or anything like that right now, either go to Wisconsin Bat Program, Google Wisconsin Bat Program, and you can read up about this, or Bat Conservation International. Or there are a number of wildlife control companies in the state of Wisconsin that will responsibly exclude bats from your house and get a hold of them prior to June 1st or after August 15th.
Jamie, David, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure, as always. We'll look forward to your next visit. Appreciate it very much. Thank you. David Drake and Jamie Knack, our guests today, and they will be back from the UW Extension and the UW Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Great to have them with us. Tomorrow, Anton Troyer is back to talk about his new book, Everything You Wanted to Know About Indians But Were Afraid to Ask. Thanks for joining us. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.